about going forward, John? This Raiders win gets the Bengals to 6-8, and it's oh so close to that magical Marvin number of 8-8. And I think what's on a lot of fans' minds, and I know we already got one listener question. Usually we save these till the end of the program. And side note, if you do have some of those, we will be trying to take some of those at the end of the program if we can. But you can hit us up on Twitter at BengalsOBI. You can leave your comments in the comment thread at CincyJungle.com or in the chat at YouTube. And then we have our text and call line open, 949-542-6241, if you want to hit us up there. But I wanted to get to this question early because it relates to a topic we wanted to talk about, and it's from it was on Twitter from Carlos Andre at Carlos Andre 31. Hey guys, do you think this win saved Marvin's job? I thought that with a 5-11 record, the odds were high, as high that they could get. I'm assuming meaning getting rid of him. I still have hope with 6-10. That's a funny statement, but I still have hope with 6-10. But if they win one more game, we're stuck with him again. Any thoughts? Greetings from Brazil. Love the show. Hude. Thanks, Carlos. Appreciate the question. As I said, we were going to talk about this as kind of a topic anyway, so the question relates well. I think that's both. I mean, it's a concern. It's an expectation. It's to me, as I sit here today, I don't know that this one means as much as the next two games in terms of a win. I think we know how the Brown family feels about the Cleveland Browns, and obviously a win against the Steelers and one that might that could potentially knock them out of the playoffs, that could play in Lewis's favor. So your thoughts about the win this week and what it means going forward for Marvin Lewis's job security. And then let's start there.
If Lewis saved his job with the win against the Raiders, his job wasn't in jeopardy to begin with. And, you know, my whole standpoint with it is that I don't think that Mike and that team operates strictly on a couple wins and losses to sway their decision making. Because to Carlos's question, he said, you know, if this win eventually leads them to becoming 7-9, so they go, 1-1 and either against with the win against the Browns and the win against the Steelers. Still a losing record, still the same record that they had last year when they brought Marvin back on a two-year contract. Like, if the Raiders win is like the main reason why they got to 7-9, and then that's the number that brings Marvin back, he wasn't – you can't tell me with a straight face that his job was at risk in the first place. And that would just only confirm that winning and losing doesn't, you know, determine Marvin Lewis's job security. So I don't – like, no, like – I feel like they have a decision right now in mind about what to do with him. And ultimately a lot of that decision is going to be laid upon Marvin. And if they happen to somehow win one of these last two games, and if that's enough to, like, you know, instill some type of surge and a desire to come back yet again and try for a fourth consecutive losing season, then that's fine. But I don't think that the organization itself is going to look at a win against a team that's worse than the Bengals at home in front of 30,000 somewhat fans in the stadium and say, yeah, this is the one, this is the thing that's going to make things okay. You know, it's the first win since October. I don't buy that, to be honest.
Yeah. And it's tough because I think you and I spoke last week before the show about my, just a side deal. My nephew met a lot of players the evening before the Chargers game. Mm-hmm. And he ended up meeting Marvin Lewis, and Marvin Lewis was so cordial and such a nice guy to him. And he actually approached my nephew, who's like 11 years old. And it's that kind of stuff where you go, oh man, we're sitting here just begging for the guy to not be employed anymore. You know what I mean? It's really sad. And I've met him, I've talked to him, and he is a really, really nice man. And he's done a lot of good things for the Bengals, but you know, a time for a change is a time for change. And even successful organizations do that. The thing that I wonder about, like you said, John, is I don't know that his job would have been in jeopardy if with a win over the Raiders, that doesn't really mean much in the grand scheme of things. And when you look at what Mike Brown said last year, when it came time to decide whether or not to bring Lewis back or re-sign him, it was that the Bengals basically knocked off two potential playoff teams. And that's what helped him decide that the team was playing well for him at the end of the year, that sort of thing. And that meant a lot to him in that decision process. Now we sit here and we go, well, theoretically, the Browns are still alive for the playoffs. I think the Steelers are still alive for the playoffs and the division crown. So, I mean, does that excuse play in there? And I mean, I go back also, John, to, is this something where we know about Mike Brown and he's not, I don't know if you want to call him like non-confrontational or whatever you want to label him as, and there are a lot of labels, but with Marvin, you almost wonder if he wants to take the white glove treatment with him and say, you know what, we've got this one year, either you stay or the opt-out is that mutual parting. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Those are kind of some thoughts rattling in my head. If you want to expand on those or your thoughts on if he comes back. I mean, like you kind of mentioned it a little bit. Is it probably going to be more of the same in 2019 if Marvin's back, or the injuries and all of that? Does that play into a potential more successful season?
So we want Marvin to essentially retire because I don't think he's ever going to get fired. If he does leave, it'll be part of his decision-making as well. We want Marvin to retire because we believe that that's like the one tangible, obtainable step in progress that we as fans can hope for. Because the underlying problem, the main problem with the Bengals is not necessarily the head coach. It's more the owner and how he runs things and obviously all those things that we have expanded upon to death. And when people talk about, you know, the Bengals wouldn't be anywhere near where they are without Marvin Lewis, perhaps that's true. But then we get upset when people say, you know, how are they going to do better than him based off where they were? I don't think a lot of us realize that if Marvin Lewis is gone, and let's just say for hypothetical reasons that Hugh Jackson is not the replacement, I truly wonder who is going to win over Mike Brown's heart in that scenario. Because Marvin Lewis's underrated ability is to, you know, somehow swindle power away from Mike Brown with whatever, you know, charm or charisma or persona that he puts on for him. And I don't know of a single coach out there that can possibly do the same thing with a man, you know, that operates and has the personality of a Mike Brown. So it honestly is curious to me, you know, when and if Marvin Lewis, you know, moves on, who is going to be the guy that can possibly, you know, convince Mike Brown to do things differently and also be a guy that Mike would even trust and would even accept into his inner circle because he's such a family man. And I think that's the reason why a lot of people think it's going to be Hugh, because he's kind of runs things similar to Marvin, has that similar personality traits, and are obviously good friends. And so Mike would trust, you know, Marvin vetting him or whatever. But I don't know. I think that's an aspect that not a lot of people, you know, think about when people talk about Marvin being the best thing for them, because Marvin might be the best kind of might be the best coach with that kind of personality that can deviate the power away from Mike in that sense.
Okay. So, and I agree with you, you know, to be honest, I think it was, actually the 2011 off season when he came back, I was like, no, after 2010, I was like, no. Right. And then when they re-signed him, I changed my tune a little bit and saying, look, this is the only guy, it seems, that is grabbing Mike Brown's ear. Mm-hmm. So that's why I was like, okay, I'm in for another turn with Lewis. And now it's turned into this after, I mean, obviously 2011 through 2015, that was enjoyable, but since it, you know, still can't win the big games. Players don't show up in the big games. We know the narratives. So I've got just a couple more questions I want to ask you on this, John. Do you think that the effort level, especially given the injuries, do you think that the effort level is potentially saving him? Near win, or at least very competitive game against the Chargers, win against the Raiders. Obviously, I thought the effort was pretty poor against some of the better teams they played where they got blown out and whatnot. The Browns, I thought the effort was pretty poor in that game early on. But I mean, do you think now that's another thing that Mike Brown might say? Well, you know what? This team, quote unquote, didn't give up on him.
Well, it all started with that collapse against the Saints. And at the time, the Saints were amounting to be as one of the very best teams in the NFL. It wasn't even close on the field. Once that like started happening and they realized just how outclassed they were compared to the elite in the NFL, things started to downturn. And then when you continue to play teams that are just more talented than you, I feel like effort at the start is already at a low because, you know, you already don't have a lot of confidence that you can beat teams of this quality. And then you face the Raiders and they start firing out of the gate because they're just even at this point, they're the better team than the Raiders. People are like, oh, they're playing for Marv. They're just playing a team that they're just clearly more talented than. They're not going to have that situation against the Browns, and they're not going to have that situation against the Steelers. Like, sure, because it is the home finale, and there is speculation that this could be Marvin's last home game. Maybe they played a little bit more extra for that, but I do think that there is something to be said about playing a team that even they know, you know, losing five straight, they're just better than they're just more talented. The roster is better, and they probably don't respect John Gruden and what he's done to start there in the first place. So I think a lot of those factors factor in more than just overall effort playing for Marvin for one last time.
This is the Orange and Black Insider Bengals podcast. He's John Sheeran. I'm Anthony Gazenza. We're talking about the situation with Marvin Lewis and what it means, what this win means going forward for his future with the club. You, John, you and both you and Matt Minich at CincyJungle.com wrote recent articles about tanking. Mm-hmm. Matt Minich's stance was tanking is not going to solve the Bengals problems is the title of that. And I glanced at that one a little bit. Basically, you know, it goes beyond – the issues go beyond needing a high draft pick type of thing. You know, it's – I think it's organizational stuff. It's, you know, things with Lewis, that sort of thing. And then you wrote one 2 days ago that was titled "The Bengals Haven't Failed at Tanking Yet." Mm-hmm. So I'm going to give mine as well. But, I mean, give us your stance at this point on the Bengals tanking their season, because I think a lot of people are like, dude, just lose out, get that high pick and do what you can with it. Whereas other people aren't so sold on that idea.
And even I like totally understand, you know, the points that Matt expanded upon in that piece. He like when they were, I don't even know what the record was, but it was about a month ago. I wrote about wanting the Bengals to continue winning because winning and losing doesn't matter when they're making long-term decision-making, specifically with Marvin or whatever. And, you know, that was at the point where they were still kind of in the playoff race and there was still a decent possibility. Since then, they didn't win. And at this point, now I'm thinking like you, like, you know, you might as well just not leave it to chance with a division win against the Browns or the Steelers. You might as well just like lose out to make sure that you do see at least some form of actual tangible change at where it matters. And the only way that we would for sure see that is if they would lose. And if that doesn't happen, if they lose, then we can really confirm that winning and losing doesn't matter in terms of that kind of thing. But, yeah, a lot of people were, like, worried that a winning against the Raiders would, like, ruin them from a top 10 pick. And I ended up doing the math, and the vast majority of teams who ended up winning six games on the year, 75% of them picked between 8th and 10th in the draft order, or at least that's where – their final alignment is. And so there's about 20 so percent chance that they get outside of the top 10, but the odds are in favor of them finishing in the top 10. But then you think back about it and you're like, you know, it doesn't really matter where they're going to draft or what their first round draft pick is. The overlying issue still exists on this roster. And if those issues, you know, persist with the same guys leading the ship, then not a lot of that is going to matter. And that's where I agree with Matt as well in that standpoint.
I'm on the fence about a lot of things with it. I mean, I think overall, if you're not going to the playoffs, I think the overarching opinion is, of course, you want the highest draft pick as possible to get the highest impact player as possible. And playing into that corner with me is something I've harped on a lot on this show and on the website is, if you're not going to move up to get an impact player, you might as well get as high of a pick as possible. Mm-hmm. To get the guy that you potentially want, because the Bengals like never trade up. especially in the early rounds, for someone significant. Instead, they wait and see who falls to them. So from that standpoint, I'd like to see them not win any more games and get the highest pick possible.
Right. And like, I think Matt talked about, you know, they need to learn how to win and to kind of eradicate as much of the losing culture as it is. But I think you and me can both agree that if this team had like a head coach within, you know, 2 or 3 years in his tenure, and they were more talented than where they are now, then you would want like them to finish the season strong, you know, to get some momentum going forward for next year, because you have stability in there. But since you're trying to push guys out of the door, winning probably delays that happening than losing does.
Yeah, year one, year two in a new coaching regime, if you're, you know, at that 6-win mark, you kind of want to say, hey, let's push and see how we can, you know. And that's, you know, year 16, there's a different attitude. But the other thing, though, I mean, I guess I'm just a little old school, and I've coached teams and stuff. So I don't even if the season is out of control, I don't like to see a team quit. And from a fan standpoint, watching the games, I don't need to see, against two bitter rivals, especially coming up here, I don't need to see them get blown out by 3 touchdowns in each game. Yeah, the injury excuse is there, but you know, I'd really like to see them make a game of it. And if they lose, okay, that plays into the draft thing. They're already out of the playoff race anyway. But I would like to see them at least put up a fight against these two teams, which is weird to say for the Browns, because that's been a team that they've largely owned. But definitely the case for the Pittsburgh Steelers. So that's – I see pros and cons to each, and some, but then, you know, sometimes high effort level will get you that win and knock you down, mm-hmm. knock you down the draft order. So there's, you know, there's a double-edged sword there. But I mean, I guess as weird as it sounds at this point, ideally I would like to see, you know, Joe Mixon get his 1,000 yards and end up having a really good statistical season. Tyler Boyd's already got his 1,000 yards. I'd like to see some of these young guys play and improve. I'd like to see the effort level be high, and if they lose, that's fine with me, I guess, because that then they would get the higher draft positioning. But I just don't like losing against – I don't like the Bengals losing against those teams. It's it's not fun. But to end this discussion, John, quickly, Marvin Lewis keeps his job if – they finish 6-8, or I'm sorry, they finish 6-10, 7-9, 8-8. What category or categories do you see him keeping his job in 2019 with those records?
I would say 8-8. I guess you can throw it in as likely, because, you know, there's precedent for last year and how they ended. 7-9. I feel like a win against the Browns and a loss against the Steelers probably isn't enough if we're still in this vacuum of these last two games meaning something and mattering. 6-10, I think, like I think that at that point, like, Marvin doesn't have a lot of energy and any motivation to continue. So I would say 7-9 with that asterisk, with that win being against the Steelers, maybe more so than it being against the Browns. 8-8. Door is definitely wide open, I would say.
Yeah, I think 8-8 he saves himself. 7-9 is dependent. I'm a little more confident in Lewis staying at 7-9 maybe than you are, because of who they play and the fact that both of those teams are in the playoff hunt. The Brown family absolutely still hates the Cleveland Browns. And then obviously the Steelers, just bitter rival. And I think if Lewis can get a win with this injury riddled team, if he can get a win against one of those teams, I think he might stay at 7-9. And theoretically, that's not a digression from last year, right? I mean, record wise. Mm-hmm. So I think that they would look at that and say, you know, then that's when you start hearing the excuse things. But I think if they lose both games, I don't think he comes back. I think 6-10.
He still could come back. Like, I don't even want to have any confidence in that statement, you know?
I guess. Yeah. 6-10, and man. I'm looking through the YouTube chat. There's a lot of different a lot of different comments and questions, or a couple of questions we'll get to later, but a lot of different comments here. And Michael Meyer says, no matter where we pick, the team cannot let Mike Brown make the first round pick. Well, he's the owner, so I don't know. I don't know how little of say he would have in that. Obviously, he's been at the head of a lot of different first round disasters with this team, but we'll let bygones be bygones, I guess. This is the Orange and Black Insider Bengals podcast. He's John Sheeran. I'm Anthony Cazenza. You can get this show on iTunes, on Stitcher, on Google Play. You can get it on cincyjungle.com. We're also on YouTube and Art19, so get the program how you can. And give us your thoughts on Marvin Lewis and what you think is going to transpire with his job coming up here. We do have a caller on the line. This is the Orange and Black Insider. Who's this?
Hey, it's John from Kentucky.
John, what's going on, sir?
Anthony, I'm looking back over the season. Remember, we started 4-1, and remember the turnovers we were getting. You remember against Indianapolis,
yep,
and Miami,
yep,
and even Tampa Bay when we didn't play so great. What happened? I actually like Terrell Austin's philosophy of let's get turnovers. What happened?
Well, I think that's a great question and a great point. I think there are a number of different issues that one could point at in terms of what occurred. I think a very inconsistent pass rush contributed. I think Terrell Austin, by most accounts, said people said that he tried to throw too much too soon at a group that kind of had their heads spinning a little bit. John Sheeran, what are some of your thoughts to John from Kentucky's question here?
I don't think it's unreasonable to say that turnovers and committing a lot and forcing a lot of them are necessarily sustainable. And people will like point to that one Charles Tillman season for the Bears where he had like forced 8 fumbles or whatever, and the Bears defense just, you know, ran train on the entire NFL. And that obviously didn't continue over to the next year. And I think just over a season, just a team that forced a lot of turnovers is more indicative of how talented that defense is. And then once injuries started with Carl Lawson and, you know, in the secondary as well with Darqueze Dennard, you know, some weaknesses started getting exposed, and then you have the entire secondary, you know, unit just completely in shambles just from a talent perspective. So I don't think they have the talent to consistently produce that many turnovers. And obviously the level of competition started to get a lot better because, you know, they faced a Colts team that was still, you know, finding its feet. They faced Jameis Winston, who was just turnover prone in general. And I think the other game was like Brian Tannehill, which, you know, those were two fluky turnovers and to begin with. So I think sustainability is the main issue. And then obviously the lack of talent compared to other top defenses kind of led to that downfall, I guess.
Yeah. And to both Johns, I think there are this team has proven to be feast or famine in a lot of different fronts. And I think that unfortunately, instead of the, you know, feast one week, famine the other week, feast where it's like almost every other week and it's a coin flip, the feast was maybe only a quarter of the time and the famine was three quarters of the time. And I think that's indicative of the record. The thing, John from Kentucky, I want to say to you and ask you about before we get you off the air, you've been a Bengals fan for a long time, so I'm sure you can kind of relate. The thing, in terms of what you're talking about with turnovers and big plays by the defense, the thing that has driven me nuts, and we just got done talking about Geno Atkins, he's one of the guys, but their main guys, their big play guys, their big time players, especially on defense, they have not shown up in those marquee matchups. They absolutely disappeared in the Chiefs game, the Steelers game, the games they needed them to step up the most, they did not step up, and I think that's been a big problem.
Yes, I agree. We've had little to no pass rush. And, of course, I'm not about to get out of here yet without bashing the head coach. I mean, during the Steelers game that you just mentioned, Anthony, you know, when we had the ball on the Pittsburgh 40-yard line to start the second half, and Marvin Lewis punched the ball. I did, you know, that I was just so frustrated. We've seen that over the years. And it's things like that is why when Marvin Lewis does leave, I don't want him in the front office. No, because he'll be up there saying, well, we don't really need to move on from Andy Dalton. Let's give him a few more years. You know, Vontaze Burfict, no, he's okay. Another year or two. Dre, no, he's up. No, absolutely no. But we clearly want to move on from Marvin Lewis. Nevertheless, I'll say this, and this is surprising. Did you bother to watch the Raiders game?
I did.
Okay. Did you see how aggressive Marvin Lewis was there for a little while? Putting his team down the field?
Yeah.
Even the announcers mentioned it.
Well, yeah.
Where has this been?
Go ahead.
Where has this been over his career?
Well,
we want to see this every game. And not just against the worst teams in the league. No. We want to see this against Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
Where has this been?
Unfortunately, John, I think again you and I have watched a lot of Bengals games over the years and a lot of Marvin Lewis over the years. I think it's at the point now where it's like, well, now we've got nothing to lose because basically the season was kind of out of control. They were playing a lesser opponent; they probably knew that, and you kind of loosen the grip a little bit, if you will, off the handles, and what do you know? It paid off. They ended up going for it. They ended up getting points and winning a game. And I don't know. I mean, he's a conservative guy, and I think that's been a big problem with him. John, we've got another call coming through. Thanks for calling, sir.
I understand. Who that guy?
All right, see you, buddy. Thanks for calling. This is the Orange and Black Insider. Who's this?
It's Terrell.
Terrell, what's going on, buddy? Good, man. Sorry. I think you called in a couple times. Sorry we missed you there, but glad we got you in.
Oh, it's all right. It's okay. I'm now trying to talk about our Bengals. And I'd like to add, I like the point y'all was making about the promo and everything. That was excellent,
though. Thanks, man.
I was going to say, I honestly think that Dwayne Haskins is the best quarterback in the draft. And when I was talking about making that risk, if the dude make that risk at taking the first round, I don't mind him sitting behind Dalton and seeing it. But basically, I just really want Dalton to have a decent line, though. And it's funny, though, because, Glenn, whatever you want to call him, whatever. And he was all right this year, but when I was at work today, somebody had the Notre Dame jersey on, whatever. And all I could think of was Quentin Nelson, who played for the Colts. So I'm like, damn, Coach. So, but anyway, I like the way I had other new quarterback. And also, going into this year to next year, Joe Mixon is a top five running back in the NFL. He's better than Gore. He's better than David Johnson. I even got him better than Camaro. Well, right now, I got him more clear right now. But I got Camaro right behind him. But other than that, you know it's Gurley and Ezekiel.
Yeah.
And, I don't want to talk about Marvin, so.
Thank you.
I'm not even going. I don't got no time, man. I'm just like,
yeah.
I'm so happy about Geno. And that's like one of my favorite players because I've been watching Geno and Dunlap like from when he was in Florida and when he was in Georgia like back in the day. But I'm glad he got another pro bowl, man. I really think that Bates and the guy from Leonard, the other linebacker in the coach, he got slow, whatever.
Yeah.
I think Bates was a better player this year than the guy that played for the Baltimore safety. I can't think of him right now, but he got one of the nominees. Moved somebody else in AFC. I thought that Bates played better than him too. But it is what it is. High superstar players,
Yep. Popularity contest. Yeah, popularity contest. Thanks, Terrell. We're going to talk about some of your stuff off the air. Appreciate you calling in, my friend.
No problem. Have a good one.
All right, you too. The main one I think a lot of people are interested in, a lot of good stuff there from Terrell, but the main one I think people will want to talk about or want us to talk about is Haskins. And he has risen up quite a bit, and rightfully so, given his stats and everything that he did this year. He has risen up quite a bit, really, over the past month or so in terms of draft positioning in this year's class. Very weak quarterback class overall. And I want to get your thoughts on him, John. I'm just going to say real quick, my thoughts, I've been a little hesitant about Ohio State quarterbacks in general. You know, system they run, all that kind of stuff. And you look back, you know, Troy Smith and, you know, these athletic guys that can run a bit, and they put up these astronomical numbers. They're in the Heisman race. Haskins is one of them. Who was the guy a couple years ago that stepped in for
Tall Gage, Cardell.
Yeah, Cardale Jones and JT Barrett and all. You know, there's all these guys that come out that have these excellent statistical college careers for Ohio State. The teams are very successful. They go to bowl games. They win national championships. But they get to the NFL, they get to the pros, and either they're undersized, they're overwhelmed by what NFL offenses are asking of them. And I don't know if Haskins is of that mold. I don't know if he has a higher ceiling than some of those guys, but there's been kind of a long track record of a lot of Ohio State quarterbacks that have come in and just kind of been blah.
Man, it's only December, and we're talking about I wanted to avoid Haskins for, like, until at least January, but I guess we're just going to do it now.
Well,
let's just do it. You have hesitation about Ohio State quarterbacks, and for me, it's kind of similar to Ohio State interior offensive line, and a good portion of my family is Ohio State graduates, and I actually saw them just over the weekend. And we were talking about, you know, Billy Price being better moving to guard, and how ever since Corey Linsley dominated at Ohio State at the center position and then got drafted and has developed into one of the better centers in the league, they've just been plugging and playing guards into center and just kind of, you know, going off of the success that Linsley had. Pat Elflein was like the Remington Award winner. Billy Price became the Remington Award winner. And then this year, Mike Jordan was the Remington Award winner. For all three of them were the best centers in the league, in the nation. And, you know, all my family who are Ohio State fans, like, Mike Jordan's not good. He's not a good center. But because of the reputation that was set upon, you know, that position in recent years past, it kind of creates this false perception that guys, just because they're wearing the scarlet and gray and they're playing center, they must be good at football. So with that, I would always say, for in terms of scouting guys, you know, you got to look at the traits. You got to look at what they actually do more so than what jersey that they wear. And a lot of people got in trouble with that with Patrick Mahomes, because people didn't trust, you know, Big 12 air raid quarterbacks succeeding in the NFL, but they didn't look at what Mahomes did well. And a lot of them got burned because he's lighting the league on fire. So it's dangerous to look at Haskins and assume that because he's an Ohio State quarterback, you know, he's not NFL caliber. But at the same time, there's also the other factors that you have to look at. You know, what kind of scheme was he in? Did he get a lot of help from his playmakers? You know, what was his average depth of target? Did he show the willingness to push the ball down the field? And did he operate well out of structure? And it's a lot of questions that obviously you and I are not well prepped to answer at this point in time, because I didn't really watch a lot of film on Haskins this year. I just watched a couple live Ohio State games. But, you know, people will know me as, you know, kind of an anti-Ohio State guy. I just, you know, being in the region and not being growing up a fan of the Buckeyes, you know, naturally I'm a little bit more pessimistic on some of those guys translating to the NFL. But just because he's an Ohio State quarterback doesn't mean that he's automatically, you know, falling in line with those other guys. But at the same time, there are legitimate questions. And I think that people who are Ohio State fans may get a little bit too high on Haskins just because he succeeded, you know, statistically, and he still has, you know, major issues that he needs to kind of go through. And maybe the Bengals are the team to provide him with the best spot. Maybe they aren't. But I think that's a question that we're going to, you know, find out here in the next coming months.
Agreed. And the reason I wanted to talk about Haskins is because that also tied in a little bit to it kind of killed two birds with one stone here with another question we had from Brian Broerman talking about drafting Dalton's future replacement. Terrell didn't say that he thinks the Bengals necessarily will draft Haskins, but, I mean, obviously he would be one of the nominees to potentially, as an early round guy, to potentially take the place of Dalton. So Brian, thank you for the question as well. I think just for now, we get the Dalton question a lot, so I think we're gonna hold off. But hopefully that kind of ties in and answers a little bit of your question in terms of Haskins and what we have seen from him and our concerns with him. We had another segment planned, but we're running kind of long on time, and we've got a slew of awesome questions this week. So I think we'll hold off on that segment for next week and just finish off with a couple more listener questions. We got a text. I believe it was also noted in the live YouTube chat from Vernon Lawson, and I love this question. Do you see any of the younger players making the jump like Tyler Boyd has, meaning probably with the one Tyler Boyd made this year? I don't know. Again, Boyd was a second year guy into a third year guy. So I don't know if you want to pigeonhole the rookies. I don't know if you want to do that. I guess if you want to say a second year guy into his third year, I'd like to go with Carl Lawson. I think unfortunately he only had one sack this year. He played in 8 games, but he had numerous pressures, only had one sack, obviously had his his season cut short. And I think that if and when he's healthy next season, you know, if you get Geno close to what he gave you this year, you still got Dunlap. If he gives you close to what he gave you this year, you give more snaps to a Lawson, to a Hubbard. I like Michael Johnson, but you know, I think his days continue to be numbered here. I think if you give those guys snaps, I think they'll produce for you. I don't know that Lawson's, you know, going to have this 15 sack explosion year. But I could see him, if healthy the entire year, getting the proper snaps and being productive. I could see him sniffing double digit sacks.
Okay. I like that. I think a simple answer would be Ross, but a lot of that is based off what the future of the offense is going to be in 2019. If Lazor's going to stay, I think we're pretty sure that Dalton's going to be starting, but I think there's more factors that go into it than that. I can see Ross, you know, not exploding to the level that Boyd did, but progressing at a level that I think a lot of us would be comfortable with. But I'm going to stick in the fourth round and go Ryan Glasgow, because he was a guy that admittedly I wasn't that big of a fan on, you know, coming out of the draft and from his rookie year. I thought he provided little upside as a pass rusher, little upside as an athlete. But just in the preseason, in the first 3 games that he played before he tore that ACL, I thought he looked like a completely different player, and to the sense where he made the necessary jumps in technique to compensate for a lack of explosion and a lack of burst off the line. He looked really good with his hands. I think he added a lot more muscle that helped him out holding off at the point of attack and run defense. And, you know, a big complaint for me has always been the lack of depth behind Geno Atkins and how he had to carry that position group next to mainly Domotopeko and now Andrew Billings. But I think Glasgow is a solid piece moving forward, and I want to see how he recovers off that torn ACL, because like Geno, when he came back in 2014, he, you know, didn't look himself. And for those guys who are, you know, near 300 pounds, it takes a little bit longer than maybe some skill position players do coming off of that injury. And that's the question that we also have to ask for Lawson as well, and how he's going to come back from that injury. But I'm excited for Glasgow going forward just because of what he showed. And I think he can develop into one of the better rotational defensive tackles in the league if he comes back healthy.
Yeah, the scary thing about a lot of these guys, a lot of torn knee ligaments, a lot of sprained knee ligaments, a lot of long-term, you know, a lot of ligament stuff this year. AJ Green, toe ligament, Andy Dalton, thumb ligament. I mean, it's a lot of, like, long-term recovery stuff and long-term keep them out of the lineup stuff. That's what's been so, I mean, I guess when we sit here and we want to knock on the medical staff a little bit, which is an easy target, you know, some of these things are just kind of like, well, when it's a ligament, it's a ligament. I don't know what more you can really do about that, but is what it is. I guess we can end with this one. We've mentioned his name a couple of times, but I thought this was a good question. Michael Myers asking about the tight end spot. Curious what this team does at the tight end spot. Is Eifert worth the money with his history? Well, that's a good question in itself. What will Kroft ask for? Another good question. and he ends with a comment about CJ Uzomah. For some reason last week, I noticed that CJ Uzomah was targeted a bunch of times and made minimal catches. I also noticed that for some reason, this is just super random. It was just a random observation. He was like throwing his body around, trying to make catches and slamming his head against the turf. His body was just like ragdollish for some reason last week. And I don't know what that was about. I haven't really seen that too much from him, but I think Uzomah's a nice number two. I think he's good what he has been traditionally for the Bengals. A good number two guy, a decent passing outlet. He's tall, he's athletic, and he can catch the ball well. I think he's a valuable guy to keep as a backup guy, but it's what you do going, you know, with ahead. And a lot of people say, well, do you use that first round pick on a tight end? Do you use maybe a second round pick, especially if it's a higher, you end up getting that higher slating of a draft selection. Maybe one of those good tight ends falls to the beginning of the second round. I like Tyler Eifert. I really do. And I like what he brings to the lineup. But at this point, it's like, it's ankle. It's ankle again. It's back. It's elbow. There's a lot of, and it comes, unfortunately, that comes with the territory of the position they play because they're asked to block and catch tough catches across the middle. But I don't know. And I don't know what Eifert's going to ask for because of the injury history. So I'd like to see him back and maybe another prove it deal, but I don't think they can rely on him.
No, they can't. But if it's all the same to him, if he wants to continue risking his body, you know, another body part to permanent damage, if he wants to keep coming back, yeah, I'll give him a 1-year deal. Like, I honestly, like, the rate of which his body is degenerating and the rate of which he's worth on the open market, they're on like a congruent plane downwards. So, they can get him for, you know, less than what they probably did from near him now. I think his final cap hit was like 5.5. He's going to be like 29, 30 years old, you know, coming off another season and injury. I can't imagine a lot of other teams, if they didn't show love to him last year in the open market, I can't imagine they're going to show any love this year. So, you know, I'm disappointed in how little how much they've limited Uzomah. In my opinion, I don't think they have him running enough downfield routes and have him using his speed to kind of stretch the field in a way that I think he's capable of doing. And I think a lot of that has contributed to his lack of production. And obviously, Jeff Driscoll couldn't hit the broadside of a barn last week, and that had a lot to do with yeah. Not just Uzoma's lack of production, but the entire receiving core. And he's been dealing with, you know, Andy Dalton's, you know, whatever accuracy issues he's always been dealing with. And obviously, Jeff Driscoll's the backup quarterback, so the situation's not great, but he's also not that upper-tier athlete that a guy like Eifert is. And I think they just trust him a lot. They depend upon him a lot too much just going into the season. And when, not even if, when he goes down, they just haven't given the confidence in Croft or, you know, Uzomah to kind of take over for him, because they are different levels of athletes. And I don't think they plan well enough, you know, when he goes out of the lineup to implement either Croft or Uzomah. As far as Croft goes, I can't imagine he's going to ask for much either. But, you know, I'm okay with bringing back Uzomah on a modest deal. I'm okay with bringing back Eifert on another 1-year deal. Again, if it's all the same to him, if he wants to keep doing this, he's still, you know, an upper tier talent when he is healthy. So he might as well just keep getting these 1-year deals until something sticks. But one thing I do know is that in general, it's better to buy tight ends rather than rely on young tight ends to produce. It's so rare for a rookie tight end to come in and produce like a number one. You have a guy like George Kittle who is in his second year and he's blowing up the league with Nick Mullins as a quarterback. But, you know, typically that year two jump is where you see tight ends, you know, actually produce. But relying on a rookie one, especially in the first round, it's kind of a losing battle and not a lot of teams have success with it. So I'm okay with relying on veterans, but whether it's Eifert or maybe a draft pick, you still have to have that athletic guy that you can trust, you know, winning down the field.
I've just got a couple more points here regarding Croft. You know, he had a nice year in 2017 in terms of stepping up for Eifert, and I think he was co-leading the team in touchdown, or he was maybe second in the team with touchdown receptions with like 7 or 8. And so, I mean, good season there. I feel like a guy with his skill set is a little more findable than an Eifert, than an Uzomah. And I, I mean, I hate to say that because he's been more consistent than Uzomi. He's had more, but I just feel like his skill set, more of a little bit more inline blocker, kind of more of the short yardagey type of stuff. I think his skill set points to a guy that is a bit more findable in the draft or in free agency. The other thing, and I don't know if you've noticed it, John, but one thing I've noticed, especially as the year has gone on and when Eifert has been out of the lineup, the Bengals have traditionally run a very effective play in the Dalton era, which is a tight end screen. And they've really done it a lot where it's just a little dump. It's almost what you see a lot of teams run with the running backs. And just because of the athleticism of some of their tight ends, particularly Eifert, it's been an effective play. You know, they're in a hole, second and long, third and long, and they do this dump off play, and Eifert will move the chains on a play where he just kind of runs after the catch. And that play has been lacking, and I think that's been hurting the offense among many, many other things. But they need to get, especially if they're going to keep Dalton, and trust me, we've got a lot of questions about that tonight. If they're going to keep Dalton next year, that's probably a play in the arsenal they're going to need to bring back, because that's a confidence builder. That's a drive, you know, a drive continuing type of play. And it just hasn't really been part of the repertoire lately. So whether that's Eifert coming back and somehow being healthy and contributing in that capacity, somebody else, and that's just one little play. I mean, we've seen Eifert make great catches and whatnot, and that's also missed. But tight end definitely needs to be addressed. Matt Langle will probably not be back, I don't think, next year. Mason Schreck is in the last year of his deal, his rookie deal, I believe. So he's got something to prove. And, you know, the Bengals have a lot of decisions to make there, because Eifert will be a free agent. Croft will be a free agent, and I think Uzama is going to be a free agent as well. If I'm not mistaken, all those guys are. So they need to do that. They need to figure that out. So thanks for all the questions tonight, guys. Appreciate it. Appreciate you tuning in. Hopefully our answers appease you. I don't know if they will or not, but we appreciate all the questions and all of the interaction that you continue to show this program, even though it has been another subpar year by the Cincinnati Bengals. You can get this show on iTunes, on Stitcher, on Google Play. You can get it on Art19. It's all of our stuff's on YouTube as well. And you can get our stuff on cincyjungle.com. One thing I also forgot to mention, and this stuff isn't on YouTube, but it's on our audio feed and whatnot. We do a post game. It's usually through the Cincy Jungle Facebook Live. We do a post game analysis video, and we end up transferring that to our podcast feed. So if you are strictly a YouTube watcher of our program, definitely check that out. It's usually immediately following the game. So definitely check that out. We bring that to you every week that we can. To talk about what transpired in the most recent Bengals game. John, Merry Christmas, my friend. It's a week early, but and it's kind of weird to say it so early, but Merry Christmas, buddy.
Merry Christmas to you as well, man.
Yeah, thanks for everything you've done for this show, and thanks to the listeners. We'll see you next episode. This has been the Orange and Black Insider Bengals podcast. We'll see you next time.
Hello, I'm Spencer Hall from SB Nation, and I want to tell you about my new show, It Seemed Smart. It Seemed Smart is a show about people doing things that, for some reason or another, seemed smart at the time. Those things might include doing a little cocaine and driving a bike up a mountain, or, I don't know, maybe racing 100 miles per hour across the country in the middle of the night with no one's permission, or even stealing a bat from an umpire's room in a Major League Baseball park. Check it out, and if you like it, tell a friend. I'm Spencer Hall. Don't do anything smart.